Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, an Iowa teenager from Waverly died from fireworks injuries. This was last weekend. It's believed to be the first person killed by consumer explosives in the state since the Iowa legislature legalized them last year. Well, let me read some details about this accident from an account in the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. Bremer County Sheriff's deputies said 18-year-old Colton Carolus was injured while shooting off fireworks with friends on Saturday. Medics with Waverly Ambulance Service transported him to Waverly Hospital, then transferred to Covenant Medical Center in Waterloo, where he was put on life support. This according to the sheriff's office. He was removed from life support at 5:30 p.m. on Sunday. His organs were donated, according to reports. Now, Sheriff Dan Pickett declined to give details about the accident, but he did say this about the fireworks. It wasn't a stabilized place that it was lit from. He said people at the residence had been setting off fireworks in a similar fashion without injuries earlier in the evening. The sheriff also said this, quote, "The fireworks that were used were basically supposed to go upward when it is lit. And this one, for some unknown reason, didn't go up. It went downward. And that's what in turn caused the injury," end of quote. He said it was a larger firework than those previously ignited that evening, I assume. Now, nationwide, fireworks deaths are rare. According to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, there's an average of 7 deaths in the country each year. Let's talk about this, the safety and the danger of fireworks, with Dr. Chris Burrish. He's a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. He's also medical director of Keokuk County Ambulance Service. Dr. Burrish, Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's nice to talk to you again.
Now, I gave you details. Those are the ones that are known at this time. What's your reaction, Dr. Burrish, given the few details we know about this tragedy?
Well, I think initially it is pretty tragic and upsetting, especially such a young guy. You know, I had read a similar article, and it sounds like he was heading off to college, and it's really a tremendous loss. Fireworks are dangerous. You know, they're explosives, and there's a reason that explosives are used as weapons. And so I think, we've had the sort of deregulation of fireworks here over the last 2 years. This is our second 4th of July under this sort of liberalized policy towards fireworks. And we know that last year we saw the fireworks injuries here at the University of Iowa more than double. I think we usually see, 8 to 10 pretty serious injuries every year. And last year we saw 21. Mm. I don't know what the numbers are from this year, but they felt like they were going to be similar. These are high temperature, burns and these explosive injuries. And I suppose that, being exposed to explosives at close range is really dangerous.
Right. And we know, it's not a surprise to us, because we hear it in the news quite a bit, that commercial fireworks injure, blow off fingers, blow off hands, blind people. But I guess here, and thankfully it's rare, if you say 7 per year average rare, that they can kill. This is something that may surprise many people. Can you see that as an emergency room doctor, that explosives that we buy for fun and entertainment can kill?
Yeah, I think, I would agree that it's probably a pretty rare thing. But this kind of explosive, kind of concussive force can do some really bad things to your body. The reason that we use explosives as weapons now, fireworks have much less shrapnel and a lot more sparkle than weapons do, but still that concussive force can do a lot of bad things to your body tissues and cause bleeding and organ dysfunction. And so I'm not shocked, truthfully, that they could kill somebody. We, over the last couple of years, have seen, dozens of fingers amputated. We have seen people blinded. And so... they can do some real damage.
All right. And I was looking up some information from the Consumer Product Safety Commission. In 2017, 8 non-occupational fireworks-related deaths. And I'm going to read a couple of the descriptions because, not to be gratuitously grisly, but you will understand, Dr. Burridge, to provide some specifics about the circumstances in which people die using fireworks so that we can learn about fireworks safety. Here, let me give you a couple of these, and perhaps you'll want to comment. 42-year-old Illinois man sustained a fatal head injury while peering into a PVC mortar tube that initially failed to launch the firework exploded. 25-year-old Kentucky man died when a shell in a consumer artillery tube he was holding exploded. A 4-year-old Wisconsin girl died when a relative lit a metal tube filled with sparklers and the tube blew apart, causing shrapnel that struck the girl who was about 12 feet away. Well, these are indications of what not to do with fireworks, right, Chris?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I would say that in all those cases, probably there was some lapses of judgment, you know, and it is hard to know, especially, you know, when fireworks don't go off, like, when is it safe to go near it?
Right.
When is it safe to check on it? But, you know, I think that the problem with saying, gosh, all those people were killed by, you know, making a mistake in judgment, is that it then gives you sort of this inappropriate sense of security around fireworks, you know, mm-hmm. makes them seem safer than they really are, because they are fairly unpredictable. I mean, you know, the fuses burn at different rates, and sometimes they fail to go off. And, you know, I think in the case of the metal tube, you know, that shrapnel is horrifically dangerous. I've taken care of 2 people that have had injuries like that, and can really do a lot of damage. And then again, the shockwave caused by the explosion causes the soft tissues of the body to deform, and, you know, temporarily, which can cause organ failure, can cause the lung to collapse, it can cause bleeding in the brain, it can cause all kinds of problems, you know, can cause your intestines to rupture. And those are really hard things to fix.
All right. And I guess the takeaway here is, don't assume, and the sheriff said it there, it was supposed to go upward. It didn't when it was lit. It went downward. It went sideways, whatever it did. Don't assume your fireworks are going to behave as advertised.
Right. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And they're just not as predictable as you would like. And to be fair, you know, I'm sure that there's tens of thousands of fireworks that go off the way they're supposed to. For every one that doesn't. But if that one is the one that you're standing next to,
yep.
You know, the numbers don't matter much.
Yeah, what a tragedy. But also, and you mentioned the uptick at the UI emergency room in the number of fireworks-related injuries. But the broader National Perspective Consumer Product Safety Commission report from 2017, 12,900 fireworks-related emergency room visits. Sparklers, the number one cause of injuries.
Interesting. Right.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, for all of us there out here who are parents, fathers, this is a tragedy we'll remember and hopefully take some lessons away from.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, my heart goes out to his family and his community.
Absolutely.
It's a horrible, horrible thing.
Okay. Dr. Chris Burridge, nice to talk with you. Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. Dr. Burridge, thanks.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations on this Friday to end the week. That's what News Buzz is about. Well, for the second year in a row, Iowa's Department of Human Services does not have contracts in place with the managed care organizations, also called MCOs, that are responsible for administering services for Medicaid patients in the state. Let's talk with IPR's Katarina Sestarek. She's been speaking with DHS Director Jerry Foxhoven about ongoing negotiations. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Ben.
So let's talk first about this point about for the second year in a row, no contract. What's going on there? What's the setting for this? Remind us.
Right. So the same thing happened last year where it took much longer than originally expected for the state to work out these contracts with the Medicaid companies. Lawmakers were upset about that because they weren't able to budget appropriately for the Medicaid contracts. And then that prompted DHS Director Jerry Foxhoven to promise lawmakers earlier this year that they would have the rates in place before the legislature had adjourned in order for them to work that into their budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's 2 months after the legislature adjourned, and there still aren't contracts. And we're into the new fiscal year, which started July 1st. The rates were supposed to be in place before the new fiscal year for this fiscal year, and they're not in place yet.
And the DHS had a meeting this week. You had a chance to talk with Foxhoven. What did he give as a reason?
So this week he kind of said that it'll be done, and he hoped to have it done sooner. And here are some more of the details he talked about.
You know, with some of the legislation that was passed, wanted a little more oversight, and so some of that stuff has to be added into the contract. Some of the other things that we develop out of the work groups that we're starting to see issues, we need to develop in the contract. So it isn't just a matter of figuring out rates. It's a matter of figuring out all of those kind of issues. How can we have, you know, a better program?
Mm-hmm. And this kind of threw a wrench into the legislature's works, right, because they have to appropriate the right amount of funds for Iowa's Medicaid system, right?
Right. And so Foxhoven also said that he doesn't know yet if the contracts will involve a significant rate increase in payments to the companies. And so if there is a very significant increase, the legislature might have to appropriate more money for that when they come back in session in January.
Mm-hmm. Katerina, rates for these MCOs are really at the center of this negotiation. What happened last year at the negotiations?
Well, one MCO left the state because they weren't granted the raise that they wanted, and the two remaining companies, Amerigroup and United Healthcare, were eventually given 3% raises, and Foxhoven says that he's confident those two companies will stay in the state for this year.
Also, we found that there's a new managed care organization this year. Let's see. My notes say Iowa Total Care. Tell us about it.
So Iowa Total Care is owned by Centene, which is a massive company, and that new MCO is supposed to start in July 2019. But a recent investigation by the Des Moines Register found that Centene has already paid millions in penalties in other states for its work as an MCO. Some of those things just involved failing to comply with Medicaid contracts and federal and state rules for Medicaid. So things like failing to pay medical claims on time, not providing enough access to doctors, not meeting certain goals and checks. They were also fined for some of their business practices. And so one of the DHS council members asked Iowa Medicaid Director Mike Randall if DHS will do any sort of special monitoring because of this news that came out. And here's his response.
We obviously will take issues such as that into consideration, making sure that whatever occurred in particular reason would not occur within the state of Iowa, or do what we can to ensure it does not occur in the state of Iowa.
Okay, Katerina, to wind up this conversation, when we think back, Medicaid was privatized here in Iowa at the start of 2016. Of course, there have been many criticisms of the way it has been managed since that time, since privatization. Plenty of Democrats, for sure, say they would want to switch back to the previous system. Do you think this is a possibility? Also, Republicans getting on board with this idea, with all the criticism?
I'm not sure if it's a possibility, but there have obviously been a lot of issues. You know, clients have reported scaled back or cut services. Healthcare and medical equipment providers have reported reduced or delayed payments. There's been disruption when clients are forced to switch between companies. And both Democrats and Republicans have called for solutions to these problems. I don't know that we've seen that yet. And some Democrats have been calling for it to go back to a state-run Medicaid program. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens after the elections.
Katerina, we've been talking about all this high-level stuff with the Medicaid director, with the DHS director, but of course, really, it boils down to the hundreds of thousands of Iowans who receive Medicaid, disabled Iowans. What does this mean for them, these latest developments?
Well, yeah, Medicaid recipients are generally either poor or disabled Iowans or elderly people in nursing homes. So what it's meant for them is either just uncertainty with whether they're going to keep receiving their care. They get switched between caseworkers and have disruptions in their care, as well as sometimes their care is cut and they have to fight and appeal that. So ultimately, it's just a lot of uncertainty and service cuts for vulnerable people.
IPR's Katarina Sestarek, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. News Buzz conversations, short conversations to end the week, the news week here. Of course, plenty of buzz nationally this week about the president's pick to fill the U.S. Supreme Court vacancy opened by the retirement of Anthony Kennedy. Also concerns over a whole host of controversial issues with that vacancy if Judge Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed by the Senate. Many concerned about abortion rights, gun rights, the Affordable Care Act, same-sex marriage, to list a few. Let's get a perspective on how a conservative cementing a conservative majority on the high court may impact us here in Iowa. Scott Peters is with us, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Ben.
A couple of things. We want to definitely talk about the open seat in the Iowa Supreme Court here in a minute. But first of all, let's start off nationally. Abortion rights supporters worry Kavanaugh could be the fifth vote in overturning Roe v. Wade from 1973. Do we know enough about Kavanaugh to say that?
I'm aware of one case on abortion he weighed in on. There may be others, but there was a fairly recent one you might remember with an undocumented minor. This is just within the last year or so. She was being held for processing and possible deportation, and she was seeking an abortion. The Trump administration was not allowing her to have one. It went into the courts. Kavanaugh voted against allowing her to have an abortion, said that the Trump administration was under no obligation to facilitate that. That got appealed to his entire court of appeals. So all the judges on that entire circuit weighed in and overturned that decision. And he wrote a dissent in that piece in which he explained his views a little bit. Now, of course, as an appellate court judge, he's not going to say we should overturn Casey versus Planned Parenthood or Roe versus Wade. But he did make it clear that he had a pretty restrictive view of what those cases meant.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, explain for us the nexus between what the Iowa Supreme Court rules and what the federal Supreme Court rules. More specifically to the point of abortion, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled last month in a 5-2 vote that women have a, quote, fundamental right to an abortion under the Iowa state constitution. So what could overturning Roe v. Wade mean for Iowa abortion rights? How do the courts work together, state and federal level, when they have the same issue, essentially?
Great question. And this is something a lot of people don't understand. In our system, the federal courts resolve federal questions. And so that means any questions under federal law, including interpretations of the U.S. Constitution. But any issues that arise solely under state law and do not in any way implicate issues of federal law, interpreting those laws are left up to the state courts alone. And so what the Iowa Supreme Court was pretty careful to do in that case from a few weeks ago was to lay out its view of how the state constitution protected abortion rights through the state constitution's due process and equal protection clauses. And so you might remember, this is very similar to the same-sex marriage case from 2009. There was nothing the federal courts could do about that. There was no place to appeal that decision to once the Iowa Supreme Court said the state constitution requires that same-sex marriage be allowed. So long as the Iowa Supreme Court continues to say that the Iowa Constitution protects abortion as a fundamental right, then Iowa would be relatively unaffected by any Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decisions.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because one tends to think that the federal law trumps the state law, but in this case, it wouldn't be so.
You can kind of think of the U.S. Constitution and its interpretation by the federal courts as setting a floor. No state can provide less protection than that when it comes to people's rights. But state laws and constitutions can provide more protections than that.
Okay, got it. Got a couple minutes left. Let's talk about the three contenders for the Iowa Supreme Court. A vacancy there. We have a state nominating commission that works differently than the federal government.
Yes,
where the president picks the nominee. A state nominating commission selected three finalists for the next Iowa Supreme Court justice. Governor Reynolds has, I understand, 30 days from that naming to make an appointment after the recommendation, which has been done. Judge Susan Christensen of Harlan, Attorney Terry Combs of West Des Moines, Chief District Court Judge Kellyanne Lecar of Waterloo?
Lecar, I believe.
Lecar. Yes. I'm kind of hurrying through those names, sorry, but we're running out of time, and I wanted to have you give us your sense of these three candidates and the fact that we have women there that will sit with all men presently.
Yes, and that's significant. At the moment, we're the only state high court in the country that doesn't have any women on the court. Of course, I think there are only two women who have ever served on the Iowa Supreme Court, and one of them was voted out of office in 2010. Yes, we have two district court judges, Judge Christensen and Judge Lecar. And then Terry Combs is a partner at a large law firm in Des Moines who has a long career in litigation, in banking, and other financial issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. You can really compare how the federal system works differently than the state system right now when you look at the news on the U.S. Supreme Court vacancy and then compare it to what's happening at the state level. And I would encourage listeners, if you do a simple Google search for Iowa State Supreme Court vacancy, you will most likely be taken to a Des Moines Register story. And at the bottom of that story about the three candidates, you can click on the videos where they had their interviews with the Judicial Selection Commission, and you can click on their application. In Iowa's system, when a vacancy occurs, people apply and they answer questions about their experience and significant legal work they've done. And so you can watch those videos and look at those applications for yourself.
All right. Well, thanks for the homework. Scott, no, it's really important homework too. And I'm getting the sense from the way you talk about it, yet another case where the federal government could learn from Iowa's system. We have that in our redistricting here in Iowa. We are a model. And it seems you might be saying we are a model also for nominating justices to the high court here in Iowa.
Yeah, I mean, there is a certain kind of politics, of course, that plays in anytime you start dealing with the appointments of people, the positions of power. But it's a notably different type of politics than what we see. It's not overtly partisan. And although candidates and applicants probably could put in their views on issues if they wanted to, none of these three did.
Scott Peters, thanks for joining us, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks for your insights, Scott.
You're welcome. It's good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. Back in just a few minutes after a short break with more of our News Buzz edition of River to River. When we come back, Vice President Pence stumps for Rod Blum in Cedar Rapids. We'll talk with Kate Payne of IPR about that. Also, the UI closing 7 centers and cutting support for 5 others. Massive cuts at the UI. We'll talk about it. And a grateful Asian community, grateful for former Governor Robert Ray. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week we learned in concrete terms how budget cuts to the UI by the Iowa legislature are having a big impact at the University of Iowa. UI officials announced this week plans to close seven centers and reduce funding to 5 others within the next year. The closures and reductions will result in job losses for 33 people at the university. Officials estimate this will give them savings of nearly $3.6 million once these cuts are complete. Sue Curry is with us, interim provost at the University of Iowa, also distinguished professor in the UI's Department of Health Management and Policy. Sue Curry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why did the UI reach this conclusion that these several centers cut and closed and the reductions at the others?
Well, these are painful conclusions to reach, but we reach these conclusions based on the need to find resources to ensure the continued high quality of our educational offerings, and that means having adequate funding for recruitment and retention of outstanding faculty, for student support services, and things that are directly related to the delivery of higher education, which is at the center of our mission.
Mm-hmm. Describe a little bit of the process that led to these specific cuts. How did you deem these programs, these centers, as something the UI can do without?
The university administrators, and that includes deans, vice presidents, and so forth, really had to look at our budget, our general education fund budget, line by line, to determine which activities could be trimmed without harming our academic mission or our student success. And at the end of the day, the president and myself received recommendations from the vice presidents and deans.
Mm-hmm. So when any organization, the UI or any organization, has budget cuts, administrators look for fat to trim. So do any of these cuts fall into that category, fat?
No. I want to be very clear that we're in a position now of, to use your analogy, probably trimming bone or cutting bone. And so we have to make some very hard decisions. Again, we take our educational mission very seriously. We have a fabulous university that serves the state well, and our goal is to continue to serve the state well by protecting our core mission of teaching and research.
Mm-hmm. How will the furlough process work for the employees, the 33 people affected?
So the furlough process is very well established at the university. There are guidelines for how much notice people need to receive if their jobs are in jeopardy or plan to be eliminated, depending on longevity at the university. And so we have followed that procedure. There's not just the work that we do to inform people and give them furlough notices, but also support services for identifying other opportunities that may exist on campus or elsewhere. And we're also very focused on that.
Sue Curry, let me respond to you. Have you respond to the reaction of the University of Iowa's Labor Center Director, Jennifer Shearer, spoke with KCRG-TV. She said to KCRG-TV she feels blindsided by this news that her center and others are closing. And you pointed out the UI's criteria was to avoid hurting students in these decisions. But she at the Labor Center says this directly impacts students, and she intends to fight. Do the people and the centers and the people affected by these have any recourse at this point? Would the UI reconsider any of these specific cuts and closures?
Well, for all of the centers that have been impacted, we have not necessarily gone to immediate closure. There is, for many of them, including the Labor Center, an academic year glide path. The university is happy to be a partner in helping to identify alternative funding sources. And if we can identify funding sources that can sustain the work that the centers are doing, the centers can continue to reside at the university and do the work that they do.
Mm-hmm. So if the university, like the Labor Center, finds its own funding, it can stay open?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that has been communicated to all these centers and their directors?
We have. This is a difficult time, and so we sometimes need to, make sure that we provide clear messages and that what we say is what is heard.
Mm-hmm. How will the savings be used?
Well, all of these dollars are important dollars. We are way behind it. So they will be repurposed, reallocated. They will not go into a savings account, for example. Those really have to do with ensuring that we have competitive faculty salaries. And we've had a relatively modest goal of being at the median of our peers, and we're not there yet in in many places, will be used to help recruit new faculty, will be used to help support student support services to ensure that students are able to succeed and graduate in 4 years, and that obviously contributes to reducing student debt. So there's, they will be used, for our educational mission.
Sue Curry, Interim Provost at the University of Iowa. Sue Curry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Welcome back to our second half hour. Coming up a little bit later in the half hour, we'll remember Governor Robert Ray, who died last Sunday, through his courageous stand welcoming Southeast Asian refugees. But first, Vice President Mike Pence was in Iowa this week. On Wednesday, he was campaigning for Congressman Rod Blum. Blum is thought to be one of the most vulnerable incumbents vying for re-election this fall. IPR's Kate Payne covered the Pence speech given at Rockwell Collins in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Kate.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tell us more about why the vice president was here in Iowa.
Yeah, so again, to campaign for Congressman Rod Blum, who has a target on his back, as it were, heading into the midterms. He's facing a really competitive Democratic challenger in Abby Finkenauer. And in his particular district, there are a lot of independent voters. And so there are many questions about which direction voters might go.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the National Democratic Party looking to pick up 20-some seats. And with those, I think it's 23 to 24 seats, they could control the U.S. House. So we'll watch that as well. There was also talk, of course, the buzz this week over the new Supreme Court nominee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh. What did Pence have to say there?
Yeah, so Vice President Pence jumped in on discussion of Brett Kavanaugh right off the bat, basically. He called this nomination a campaign promise kept by the president to put another judge on the court with a real originalist interpretation of the Constitution. And Pence spoke to that here.
He is, as the president said, a man of impeccable credentials, unsurpassed qualifications, and a proven commitment to uphold the Constitution of the United States as written.
And of course, the senators key in approving Brett Kavanaugh to the high court. And our senators here in Iowa, Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, Chuck Grassley, head of the Judiciary Committee.
Absolutely. And Vice President Pence did name Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst in particular, saying we can depend on them in getting this nomination through and getting Judge Brett Kavanaugh on the bench.
Mm-hmm. I understand he had something to say about tax law as well.
Yeah, that was fell into his larger theme of more campaign promises kept. He said that this is the largest tax cut since Ronald Reagan, and that it's part of the president's push to get through red tape and let business boom, basically, in this country.
So Kate, he was at Rockwell Collins in Cedar Rapids. Why was he there? How was the reception?
Yeah, so it's the largest employer in Cedar Rapids. There are about 9,000 employees across the state and 30,000 across the world. So it's a big player. And as far as the folks in the room, many of them were part of the Rockwell Collins PAC. So they're politically inclined and donate to a number of different candidates, Democrats as well. But we're certainly keyed into wanting to hear the vice president speak more broadly about politics and not just as it pertains to Rockwell Collins employees.
And, of course, while the vice president made his visit here to Iowa on Wednesday, the president was a half a world away in Europe at the NATO summit and then the United Kingdom visit. But he somehow made his presence felt, right?
Absolutely. The vice president definitely wanted to represent Donald Trump. And what better way than to read a tweet of the president's? And the vice president really wanted to show that Trump is thinking about farmers right now at a time when there are a lot of fears in Iowa and across the country how the president's trade policies are impacting American products, Iowa products. And so, yes, Pence did read a tweet of Trump's saying, I know that farmers are nervous, but trust me, in effect. And here's that tweet.
But then he made a promise. We will open things up better than ever before. We're going to have a level playing field, he said, and our farmers will start winning again.
Wow, he's really got the president's cadence down there, Kate.
Yes, yeah, something very Trump-like about it, for sure. But it's interesting, Ben. It was very striking to hear Pence's comments on how farmers are doing when many farmers and manufacturers, producers in the state are saying the opposite.
Are worried.
Yes, are very, very worried.
Okay, IPR's Kate Payne talking about covering the speech that the Vice President Pence gave at Rockwell Collins in Cedar Rapids. Thanks for stopping in, Kate.
Thanks so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we heard in that news from Charity Nebbe just a moment ago, funeral services to be held this afternoon, in fact, in just a few minutes, in Des Moines for the late Governor Robert Ray. He died last Sunday at the age of 89. Governor Ray, holding our state's highest office from 1969 to 1983. Yesterday, his body lay in state in the Statehouse Rotunda. Hundreds of Iowans came to pay their respects, Ray's granddaughters, members of the Asian community, and Governor Reynolds, each laying a wreath at the flag-draped coffin before the crowd was allowed to circle around. Now, Ray said he was especially proud of his work in the mid-1970s to resettle refugees from the Vietnam War here in Iowa. Our state became one of the largest settlement locations in the U.S., and it was due to Governor Ray. And Ray dismissed any notion that relocating thousands of people fleeing Vietnam to our state, a largely rural Midwestern state, would carry political risks. Here's what he had to say. He said it was saving the lives of refugees. People would say, you might not get reelected. And I would say, I can make more money if I don't get reelected. Robert Ray's quote there. Lynn Ta is a reporter for the Des Moines Register. You've heard many times on this program talking about her reporting. Now I'd welcome her on the program to talk about a very personal article she wrote this week titled, My Dad Was a Refugee Who Came to Iowa Thanks to Robert Ray. Now I choose to make this state my home. Lynn Ta, welcome to our program. Lynn, are you there?
Yep, I'm right here.
Okay, got you now. You say in your article you never met Robert Ray and weren't alive when he was in office. If I can quote from your article, now as a 25-year-old journalist, learning about the death of former Iowa Governor Robert Ray has hit me in a different way. How so? How did it hit you differently?
It's really interesting because, you know, there's this person who, you know, was governor before I was even alive, but the trajectory that my life has gone and what I've been able to do in Iowa and the people that I've met and just being in the U.S., I mean, I don't even know if I would have been able to kind of get to live the life that I've been able to kind of without Robert Ray. So it's kind of interesting to think about that and think that this person that I've never met before in my entire life has had such an influence on me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we only have about 5 minutes left. That's a shame we have so little time, but tell us quickly about how your father came to this country. He was sponsored and at times had a harrowing experiences before coming to Iowa.
Yeah, so when my father was 15 years old, he decided to go off by himself in 1978 and try to escape Vietnam at that time and try to come to the United States. You know, so he went and traveled on the ocean, was able to make it to Thailand, where he stayed at refugee camps for a couple years. And then finally, when he was 17, you know, he gets to hear that there is a family in Urbandale, Iowa, that is willing to go and sponsor him. So he flies on a plane for the first time in his life, comes here, goes to, you know, Merle Hay Mall and, you know, witnesses escalators and elevators for the first time and just, you know, what American life is like. And so, you know, since then we've called Iowa home and have just tried to, you know, make a living here. And, you know, this is our community now.
Right, right. And going back to that sea journey, that harrowing sea journey, to quote from your article, for 3 days and four nights they were out in the Pacific Ocean with only water in sight. Pirates ransacked their ship multiple times, pillaging them of what few possessions they owned. Wow. Fast forward to 1999, you write that Your father helped open the first Vietnamese restaurant in the Des Moines West Side, the Saigon Cafe in Clive.
Yeah. So my dad has always been a great chef, and cooking Vietnamese food has just always been a major pride in our family. And so what he really wanted to do was be able to introduce that to a part of the Des Moines Metro that hadn't experienced Vietnamese food before. So he would do different things like teach people, you know, how do you eat a spring roll? How do you dip it in here? Bánh xèo, which is a kind of Vietnamese crepe. It's yellow. It's got bean sprouts and shrimp and just different items in it. It's a dish that you typically don't see at an American restaurant. And so my father would go and show people, you know, you wrap it in lettuce. You kind of dip it in fish sauce. He showed people how to eat pho. You know, you don't twirl your chopsticks like you're eating spaghetti, showing them how to properly use their spoon and slurp it. And so especially growing up in the restaurant, it was always kind of amazing to witness just so many people from the Des Moines community who had never experienced Vietnamese food before come in and be so willing to try it and take part in something that my family has loved and enjoyed so much.
Mm. I wanted to quote again from your article. Being a second-generation immigrant in Iowa has its cultural oddities. I'll eat, is it congee? Congee?
Yeah.
I'll eat congee, that's a rice porridge, for breakfast, and smash a Pancheros burrito for lunch. I'll always be navigating the nuances of American culture and Vietnamese culture, but what I feel like I know best is Iowa culture. What a wonderful line, Lin Ta. Where's your dad this week?
So they just got back from the Bahamas yesterday.
All right. So there's the ship. The ship theme again, huh?
Yes. Yep. he saw all water, but instead this time he was able to eat endless food at a buffet. So
wow.
a big difference.
Is there a special way your family is honoring Robert Ray this week as Iowans mourn him and say goodbye to this beloved governor?
Yeah, so just within our family, we've kind of just been talking about, you know, how we came to Iowa and just how lucky we are just to get to be at this state and experience all these different things and kind of talking about where we came from and you know, our Vietnamese heritage, but also kind of how it's mixed, you know, with our own, we call Iowan heritage as well. We've just been discussing it and you know, how lucky we've been able to come to this state.
All right. We're lucky to have you on our airwaves. And as a reporter for the Des Moines Register, Lin Ta, check out her very personal article this week at the Des Moines Register website. My dad was a refugee who came to Iowa thanks to Robert Ray. Now I choose to make this state my home. Lin Ta, we'll talk to you again about some of your reporting in the future. But for now, thanks again.
Thank you.
Let's go over to Tony Daner of Iowa Public Radio, the Studio One Tracks host. Tony, you're going to groove us into the weekend, right?
Surprise, Ben, it's me.
Oh, my goodness. I was switched up twice there. Mark, great to have you on board. I understand we're going to hear some music from a band that will be featured on Ragbri.
As a matter of fact, yes, this band, the
Not going to switch me up there, okay.
What are you talking about? The Jayhawks have a brand new album, band that's been around for a few decades or so, and they also are going to be playing for the overnight stop in Iowa City for Ragbri 2 weeks from today.
All right, let's hear a little bit of the Jayhawks as we go out. Mark Simmet, Iowa Public Radio's Studio One Tracks host. Thanks, Mark, and find out where Tony is, would you?
I know he's around here somewhere.
Right.
This one's called Everybody Knows, the Jayhawks from their new album Backroads and Abandoned Motels.
Tell me now. Would you know me? See behind the smile.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Caitlin Harrop, and Emily Woodbury, with help from Lulu Dewey and Lucy McGeehee today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. Everybody.